Hi, my name's Richard, and I am here for numerous reasons, including mental health issues and primarily alcoholism and other addictions. I came to started coming to Tusnua, I guess, over a year ago, and then picked up on becoming host for the Tuesday meeting, which is a catch-up meeting. But I started writing about my recovery experiences and well-being experiences for that meeting and reading them aloud just as an introduction. And then I accumulated quite a few of those. And Ali, who also comes to Tusnua, edited them for me, and I've used them as a basis for what I hope will be a chat book that I'll, or an online book that I'll share with everyone. So part of my presentation today is to read a couple of those, and then hopefully there'll be a trigger for describing what else happened in my experience of recovery and prior to that. So I'll start out by just reading briefly just a page of something I wrote about. But the first time I realized that I was had more going on with my alcohol than most people. In 1962, I joined my first ship, the MV New Zealand Star, at King George V Dock in London. On my first night ashore, I stepped alone along the dingy, deserted East End dockside street and heard a piano playing cheerfully from a pub. Although underage, I opened the pub door and a welcoming mayhem greeted me. I had never known anything like it before. I felt a switch go inside me flip from off to on. I weaved lithely through the loud, loopy throng to the bar, where I ordered a pint of bitter, then edged into a standing space by a table. I recognized some crew there, but they didn't acknowledge me. The tabletop was covered with pints of beer that sat in a pool of spills. Someone stood up and pushed his chair toward me, and I sat down, expecting a greeting, but none came. I enjoyed the piano, jolly piano playing in the affirming, inebriated noisiness with smells of smoke, sweaty bodies, and beer. Feeling giddy, I cautioned myself to sip slowly. My pint sat two-thirds full on the table when the sailor who had given me his chair stumbled by. As he did so, he dropped a shot glass of whiskey into my beer. I sipped my first Boilermaker and entered bliss. Everything changed with the taste of heaven. I would never be the same again. I had never felt like I was anyone before. Suddenly, I was not a strange, gawky lad from Yorkshire. I was me. Cheers, I shouted to the throng, waving my glass, and hardly noticed. Thus started my active, destructive alcoholism. By the time I had completed my first trip, I was repeating cheers in multiple subtle bouts of extreme boozing. And shortly after, in Auckland, New Zealand, I realized that my alcoholism was unmanageable. A young evangelical preacher visited the ship and talked to me about salvation. In a moment of transcendent bliss, I threw myself to my knees and begged forgiveness. Thus began my first recovery effort. Serious drinking started when I was 17, and then I got straight, got clean for a number of years. The religious part lasted a number of years. I would preach at evangelical meetings. I was very much into it, and I would go to Youth for Christ rallies and speak at churches and evangelize on the streets. I don't know if any of you remember Dave Wilkerson and starting up his program in New York. I'd go there and do all kinds of cool, interesting stuff. I didn't work on any of my issues. I was still a very angry person, and but it kept me sober. I didn't even think about drinking because drinking wasn't part of it. And then I was sober and met someone and came ashore and got married, and we were both in the church. And then I got a job in law enforcement with Surrey Constabulary, Police Constable 1007, believe it or not. And I got into that, and then gradually the church going slipped away. And then I was drinking again. Drinking initially just as drinking, I was a happy drunk. It wasn't that I was suddenly inebriated and unable to perform. But I worked at that for a while, and then I got into working with juvenile delinquents and took some exams and got into university. And then I'd go back to sea for short trips, filling in, substituting. All the time drinking, just carrying on, just typical drunken sailor, and then went to university, and I eventually got a job teaching in a college in England at Brunel in Bristol, and went to Poland. Gosh, I didn't know I was going to talk about all this. Went to Poland to teach at Adam Mickiewicz Summer School because the Polish students under communism couldn't leave English, and they were trained to be spies, so they had to speak impeccable English. Anyway, then I came and met someone there, came to America, and can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, came to America. And for a creative writing program. And wow, gosh, a lot happened. And then ended up in Florida where I was seriously drinking. I mean, like big time, and using. I didn't start using really until I met Americans and started using pot. And then in Florida, of course, it was hardcore stuff. And that's when I had my first major bottoming out. And I wrote about that. And that happened in South Florida. South Florida in the 1980s was crazy, man, crazy. Anyway, this is what I wrote about my bottoming out there. During a torrid Florida August at 4:30 a.m. in the rowdy parking lot of the Tadpole Lounge, my mind snapped. I had started losing it at the bar as I argued with my latest dysfunctional crush, Jenny, after she became tired of my obsessive attentions that she had provocatively encouraged. We left the lounge drunk and high and yelling at each other. Our aggressive behavior was hardly noticeable in the drunken, druggy mayhem of turning out time turmoil. We stumbled our rage through the feisty throng toward the beat up dart slant six that Jenny had bought without a title. I stomped off to recover my nearby bicycle. Her revving engine revved my brain. As I regained my bike, I saw her car move toward me. Suddenly, she sped up and drove straight at me. I froze. Then, in an adrenaline rush, everything slowed to become a leisurely dream. The lumbering car sluggishly rolled toward me, and I could see her shaping slow-mouthed curses. And suddenly, something snapped in my head. I picked up my bicycle and hurled it at her windshield. The car swerved along the sidewalk, spilling drunkards left and right before bouncing back onto the road. My brain did snap. I can almost feel it now. Amid the pain and bedlam, I thought very clearly, so that's what people mean when they snap. And I realized I should stop using crack, nothing else, and get help. So I did get help. I started therapy. So I'd moved on from being from just not drinking because I had a belief to actually trying to deal with some of the issues that had made my brain snap, which was also alcohol and drug related, of course. But it was also related to the fact that I was working in child protective and in training realized that I displayed all the behavioral indicators of a child who'd been severely abused, emotionally, physically, and sexually. So I got into therapy and that helped a little. It didn't affect my drinking or drugging, not really, except the night before when I tried to clean up a bit, because I did take it seriously. And then the self-help movement started, and things like Nurturing Your Inner Child and all kinds of those early books, which were brilliant for me, because suddenly I realized that I could peg myself as being part of a group of people. Until then, I hadn't really thought there was anything wrong with me. I thought there was something wrong with the rest of the world, that there weren't more like me. But I realized that I was really fucked up and that it wasn't okay. It wasn't really working for me. So I got into self-help stuff, but that still didn't affect my drinking, although I did join things and stop drinking. I can't remember the exact sequence of all this. I mean, there's a lot gone on. But for instance, I joined the Baha'i. I joined the Baha'i and met a woman there, and I was dating, and then I'd stopped drinking, and she had the nerve to, I felt really insulted. She had the nerve to tell me that she was only attracted to alcoholics. She was in 12 steps. And she wasn't attracted to me because I wasn't an alcoholic. I find it very perplexing. Anyway, having failed that venture, I had other, I got into some new age stuff, and stopped drinking for that. So, but each time I got back into drinking, it's progressive. You know, your recovery is progressive. Each time I go back and do something, I do it less than before. You know, coping better next time is my definition of recovery, and coping worse next time is my definition of dysfunction. And I got worse and worse, and then I'd stopped again. Anyway, eventually I moved to New York to work with victim service agencies as a trainer and met Trudy, who was a former hooker, turned child outreach worker. Wow, gosh, there's a lot. Anyway, I'll cut to the chase and keep it simple. And then moved to Florida. And in Florida, this is 30 years ago, and I've been married now to the same person for 30 years. But during that marriage, I realized that my drinking had got totally out of hand. And then Roberta had to call the cops a couple of times. And the last time I was arrested about 10 years ago, I was 70, woke up in a police cell. And oh Lord. Woke up in, I sorry, I put my thing on airplane mode, but it still rang. I woke up in a police cell and I thought, oh, this is serious. I've got to stop drinking. I was familiar with the 12 steps, by the way, by this point. Anyway, I got home And I thought, oh, this is really serious. This is no way for a 70-year-old to act. I thought, oh, I won't drink tonight. That'll sort it out. I'll keep happy. And I just couldn't metabolize my drink like I used to at all. Anyway, and then I thought, no, this is really serious. I better not drink for 3 nights. And I thought, I can't do it. No way I can stop drinking for 3 nights. And that was the point at which I acknowledged I was an alcoholic. That was the first time I'd acknowledged it. Other times I'd joke about being a functioning alcoholic or say, well, my life isn't totally unmanageable in every area. And I was putting Roberta and Max, my son, through hell. Because I had some mental health issues that I was not dealing with. I was self-medicating. Anyway, that's when I realized that I had to get into AA. So I got into AA and went to AA meetings. Initially, step three had always been a problem for me, but I thought, well, I'll just act as if it's all true, fake it till you make it. So went to my 90 days meetings, stayed sober for that, and then I got a sponsor, but that didn't really work out. I'd call people, but they'd call back once. I didn't really fit in socially there any more than anywhere else, for instance, my sponsor would say, "What step are you working?" And I would say, "This is a neurodivergent answer." I would say, "Well, it depends what's happening. If I need to forgive someone, I'm working that step. If I need to do that, I'm working." I said, "I regard it more like a chart. Like if I'm navigating, well, step four is a lighthouse over here, so I need to go toward that. And step seven is a church steeple on the there, and blah blah blah." And I'd blag on about this because I just don't have this linear way of thinking. And then I said, "And my higher power is the stars I steer by." Well, of course, for your average Joe who's a AA sponsor, this is like way over. It's just like nonsensical. So anyway, when COVID came, I started coming online to meetings and found secular meetings, and then I'd also got into neuroplasticity and learning about how your brain can actually change and develop new thought patterns. And that's what really got me going, because I got totally intrigued by the idea that simply by being willing to change and open to change, my brain actually would change. And also that, like everything else in my body, if I treated it well in a healing way, and for the brain, that's being a little calmer, think being kinder, being less judgmental, having fewer strong preferences, all that kind of stuff. Just like anything else, my brain would heal in the same way as if I had a cut finger and I kept it clean, and or if I was sick, if I rested. It's the same thing for my brain as it is for the rest of my body. If I take care of it, nourish it well, for most of my life, I never took any advice at all from anybody. I was proud of being arrogant and self-willed and doing my own thing. And I find it really annoying that they were right, that good diet, exercise, clean living, and call it what you like, meditation. I don't really call it meditation, but calming down, calming my mind down, taking a pause, any of those things, they all work. And they worked for me. And now I would say that my life isn't always even. I'm getting bent out of shape out of a situation. I've got this week and getting, I've been annoyed by it, but that doesn't matter because fundamentally, I like the analogy of the ocean. Like the ocean surface can be stormy or nice or whatever, but what matters is that at the base, the ocean floor is stable. And I think as I progress, I do become more basically okay and less trying to fix what's wrong. And that's a big difference. So I'm really now not so much just working on problems, but working on my well-being, which is always with me, my sense of peace, my sense of enjoyment, things that I used to neglect. There's lots of things that we do naturally in what's called the brain's default mode, which is where everything's fine, everything's calm, you're all right, you know, as you begin to wake up or drift into sleep, when you have a flow experience, when you're fully engaged in something, when you're singing or dancing, whenever you're fully engaged or very calm, you have this core called the default mode. It's easy enough to look up online, which is your well-being, and you always have that with you. It's just that when I was very dysfunctional, I buried it with my anxieties and my concerns. Now I spend more and more time nurturing it. So if I have a good feeling about something, I remember that feeling and I go back to it. And that is one of the things that's helping me grow and change and just become more of the me I should have been. I've always had the ambition that I would become the me I would have been if I'd been loved as a child and nurtured as a child. And as I said to my therapist, if you don't bond with your mother, you're fucked. But I'm not as fucked as I used to be. And sobriety and not taking drugs is a big part of that. And what I've learned about myself and accepting myself and knowing myself has just changed everything, which is why I can take part in meetings like Tus Nua and not feel that I'm a stranger, not feel that it matters if I'm not the same as everyone else, or have an odd way of presenting myself, or seem different because, love and tolerance is our code, and I feel both of those here, and I'm very grateful for it. And I hope that what I've said has been helpful to someone. So thank you very much for inviting me to speak, and I'll turn over, I guess, turn over the meeting to the members. Thank you.